You're listening to Queers, a podcast about politics and culture with Simon Copland and Benjamin Riley.
That was good.
It's the 5th of June, 2017. I'm Benjamin Riley.
And I'm Simon Copland.
Welcome to Queers. Each episode, we talk our way through questions on a theme, and this week we're talking about homonationalism. But before we get into that, I wanted to talk about a conversation I had with a friend of mine about our last episode. He told me he was going to write it in as an email, which you can do at queerspodcast@gmail.com. But then we were just talking and he was like, I can't be bothered. I'll just tell you about it. The last episode, of course, we were talking about queers' relationship to the state and, you know, wondering why it's become increasingly common for queer political movements to be primarily seeking recognition from or protection from the state around issues like marriage equality and things like anti-bullying programs in schools, that sort of thing. And my friend said a point that I really liked, which was the kind of obvious one that, you know, a really potentially good reason why that might be the case is because for a lot of people, perhaps even most people, you know, want to feel a general sense of belonging in society, and so kind of the state is effectively just a kind of vehicle for that sort of broad social legitimization, which is it's almost like a too obvious a point to make, but I don't think it's something that we said quite that explicitly, and it kind of raised the question for me of, I suppose we sort of covered whether or not that's a good thing in the episode, but, you know, how we might kind of promote or even think about projects for, we sort of talked about it at the community level, like talking about recognition and legitimacy within our own communities. But I think there is some value to, for example, seeking recognition, seeking inclusion within a kind of broader society, you know, and obviously there is, that's something a lot of people want. So what might that even look like outside of the doing that through the state, through institutions like marriage? And the kind of obvious thing that I realize is the answer to that is something that is already happening a lot in queer communities around the inclusion of queer people in media, in sport, in business, that sort of, you know, trifecta of what I think of as very kind of representative politics, but perhaps are linked to that broader project of social inclusion in a way that I am maybe unfairly dismissive of.
Yeah, and that sort of representative politics is something that I'm less critical of than I am of representative politics in terms of people trying to get, you know, gay leaders of a state, of a government, because I think it has the potential to connect more strongly with the day-to-day life experiences of queer people, and is more of a community-based approach to that kind of stuff rather than relying on the sort of the power and authority of the state. I think it's a really good point that your friend brought up, definitely one we didn't really consider, but a really obvious one, and so much of the marriage equality debate is really about belonging, so it's definitely an interesting point. I mean, maybe something we can think about, like, how can we talk about that sort of sense of belonging as maybe a topic for another episode, because I think it's a really interesting one.
Yeah, I agree. So let's take a deep dive from there into the heady topic of homonationalism.
Well, homonationalism occurs when political leaders, queer people, and queer organisations use the rights of queer people to justify racism, xenophobia, and nationalism. It is an ideology that equates particular cultures or religions as inherently anti-queer, in turn justifying the oppression and discrimination against that culture or religion.
Homonationalism has arguably been on the rise in recent years and has become particularly relevant with the oppression of queers in places like Russia and more recently Indonesia hitting the headlines. Political leaders and queers alike have used these situations to create a black and white picture which pits the liberal progressive West against the rest of the world.
An example of this could be found in queer responses to anti-gay legislation in Russia over the past few years. Many queers have taken a particularly anti-Russian tone in protesting these laws, blaming the entire country and its sort of backward nature for the legislation. This, for me at least, was maybe best epitomised by the booing of the Russian contestant at Eurovision last year, which we spoke about in an episode last year, and a scenario in which queers were not only protesting the laws, but in essence protesting Russia itself.
With these global events, we thought it would be worth investigating homonationalism as an ideology. What is it? How did it come about? And what can we do about it? So, given the complexity of this topic, I thought a good place to start, Simon, would just be to expand a little more broadly on maybe the origins of the term and, you know, what, how we understand it to play out. So do you want to have a talk about that?
Yeah, so homonationalism is actually a relatively recent term as far as I understand it. So yeah, it was framed by a person called Jasbir Puar. They just sort of describe it as the processes by which powers line up with the claims of LGBTI community in order to justify racist and xenophobic positions. So it's really, I think, you know, in essence, the way I'd potentially describe it is a sort of ideology or a frame that, that positions the West primarily, or in our position, Australia or a particular country, as having this sort of enlightened, progressive perspective on LGBTI rights. A sort of perspective that is driven both by queer people and by state leaders who want to sort of jump on that bandwagon. And it's taking that sort of progressive perspective and using it as a way to criticize another country or another culture or another religion, and to sort of paint that culture or religion as inherently backwards because of its position in relation to queer people, because of oppression that is sort of inherent to that culture or to that religion or to that country. So it's sort of painting anti-queer prejudice, I guess, in a very nationalistic tone, saying it's not just about a particular ideology or a particular political perspective that might be occurring in a country that is having, you know, anti-queer oppression. It is inherent to that country itself or to that culture itself. And therefore, following on from that, the West is inherently better because we have a far more enlightened position on those issues. That's sort of how I see it, I think.
In thinking about this topic and doing a bunch of reading about it ahead of today, in some ways it feels like a really extreme logical extension of a lot of what we talk about on the podcast. So in some ways, to me, it almost feels like a really sort of extreme extension of respectability politics. You know, in that it is about queers being co-opted into the project of othering. So certain, usually more kind of, you know, I use this with all the inverted commas one can, most acceptable queers, you know, to mainstream society, I guess, having some legitimacy in marking out something that they are not, you know, a kind of I guess it's a way of conflating the bad queer with a kind of racial other, I suppose.
Yeah. I see what you're trying to say. Like it's taking. So we have an acceptance of the acceptable queer in Western societies, and it's using those acceptable queers as a way to target another other. And we've sort of spoken about how often that respectability politics targets an other within queer communities, within Western cultures, or within Australia in our specific circumstance. And this instance, it's using it as a way to target the other that is the foreign person or the foreign country or the foreign culture or the foreign religion that we want to target in this way. And it's using that acceptable sort of person to be able to do that. And I think then in turn sort of painting ourselves or painting our own country as this sort of great beacon of hope and great beacon of, I keep using the word enlightenment because it's just the one that keeps coming back up, or this great egalitarian society that is inherently better than this other out there, and sort of co-opting queerness into that.
I mean, I think it also does have the effect of othering queers, certain kinds of queers as well, in that the people who are included in this. Now enlightened is the only thing that's popping into my head.
Sorry.
But it's actually kind of, you know, given the sort of ideas of the Enlightenment Project, it's not a bad one to use. You know, the queers who are included within that sort of homo-nationalist discourse are the most acceptable ones, and it does kind of exclude, and it sort of has to render invisible anyone that is excluded within our own social context. So anyone who is, for example, excluded in the project of like marriage equality, in the ways that we talk about that, in that it benefits certain kinds of queers, homonationalism does the same thing. It's about kind of drawing a circle around a certain kind of queer person and pitting them against an other.
Mm. And I think, you know, I think maybe if we go back to the specific example that we brought up in the introduction, the Russian example, what that was doing was it's at the most basic level, it's othering the Russian queer in many ways by associating them, you know, with the culture that is apparently the sort of the cause of the anti-gay legislation that occurred. I'm not a big fan of the term erasure, but like it erases that person, that the Russian queer, it erases the experience and the history of Russian queerness, and sort of others them as not being sort of part of the us, and the us of the good queer over here who is doing that sort of acceptable, who is now part of the sort of acceptable part of society, I guess. And so it's bringing that otherness, I guess, into a giving it a real racial tone or a cultural tone that doesn't exist in some other parts of that respectability discourse.
I feel like what you're saying sort of implies that, I guess this is just the process of like stereotyping. Yeah. It's like this erasure on both sides by like setting up this duality of, the enlightened West that includes like gays because we're so progressive and blah, 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 against the sort of, you know, regressive, racial other who's backwards and who, you know, treats their queers terribly. It both erases queer traditions in other cultures, but at the same time, you know, erasing sort of, you know, quote, bad queers in our own culture. So there's that interesting kind of duality there.
Yeah, and it's one that I actually, before you sort of raised it, I hadn't thought of it in that kind of way, but I think it is a good point. I'd sort of always thought of homonationalism as really being focused on that, the sort of external, but the way it sort of has the capacity to erase or to other people within communities as well is just as important in many ways as the way it raises groups, you know, or countries or cultures outside of the space of the country that we're in, or the West in general.
Well, I feel like it speaks to the sort of hypocrisy of homonationalism, that it not only becomes a discourse that is an excuse to be racist, basically. Mm. It also becomes an excuse to not to kind of examine the ways that queers are treated badly within our own culture.
100%.
By sort of imagining that everything here is kind of fine and rosy and perfect when, you know, we've got, you know, and you know, every country has issues with the way it treats queer people.
Yeah, and I think that it's not just about, and maybe expanding upon that, because I think you're 100% correct. I think it also gives an opportunity to sort of ignore the way a country may treat other minority groups as well. And I think that creates that sort of blocking out that space of like, you know, we're really great for queers, which in most Western countries is not 100% the case anyway. And so that makes us really great with it, whilst ignoring this other space out there of what, you know, how we treat other minority groups, and it sort of removes that potential for solidarity. We talked a little bit before we recorded, or, you know, one of the examples we discussed a little bit earlier was the example of Pauline Hanson tweeting about the awful, you know, how can Malcolm Turnbull call Indonesia a moderate country when they, you know, when they flog gays, for example. And it's a really good example of a leader who is quite happy to exclude a whole range of minority people, minorities from her sort of discourse. And has a terrible record on that, but being able to use gay rights suddenly being really the champion of gay rights as a way to justify that, as a way to justify her own position and to sort of paint Australia as this sort of, again, I use this word, enlightened place, or this progressive place on social issues, which is quite funny coming from someone like Pauline Hanson, as a way to then sort of shut out a whole bunch of other groups. So it's about, so I think that's a really important element too.
Totally. And I think that sort of says something interesting about the nature, I mean, not to get too esoteric too quickly, but about the kind of nature of of queer politics, or maybe LGBTI politics as a project. Pauline Hanson is, you know, a politician who is notorious for quite racist positions on various things over the years. I'm like, should I euphemize that? No, I probably don't need to.
No, I think you're right.
Yeah,
it's almost about a siloing of gay rights as a specific rights group. Gay people or queer people as a specific identity group that have a specific rights claim that are focused solely around that that identity status, and not seeing the connections between the oppression of queers with the oppression of women, with the oppression of people of color, or et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, and not seeing, which I would make the case that those oppressions are all sort of interlinked or have similar. They're all got the same systematic underpinnings. And so, but when you see, when you're able to isolate groups, identify group, hey, you're gay or lesbian or bisexual or transgender, identify that group individually, focus energy on that individual rights discussion, focus energy on those individual rights for those individual groups, then you can sort of isolate groups together and sort of almost play a divide and conquer kind of role where you divide these groups apart from each other. Because you say, look, these people over here are against your rights, and so they're the enemy.
Totally. Well, I mean, we're just talking about identity politics as we always do.
Oh,
I mean,
this
is kind of weirdly similar to what we were talking about on the last episode. You know, that once you was I think it was the last episode that once you kind of name something, once you carve off a particular group as having a discrete identity in that way, then they can be more easily co-opted into ideological systems.
I'm gonna have to be careful here that I don't, because I'm doing so much research on that very topic at the moment, that I don't bring back every episode to that sort of analysis.
Oh well, I'm right there with you, so it's fine.
I think that would be the argument that I make. It is about the capacity to isolate those groups and then turn them against each other in that kind of way. And you see it, I think homo nationalism is probably the best example of it, because I think it is quite common in that way. And maybe that's because of the sort of anti-gay backlash that we've seen in recent years in places like Russia and Chechnya recently, which is obviously part of Russia, but a sort of different example.
Parts of the Middle East as well.
Parts of the Middle East, parts of Africa.
Where violence against queer people, and the same in Africa as well, where violence against queer people has explicitly been kind of framed as in opposition to, like, quote, Western values in a lot of instances.
Yeah, actually, I think that's a really good point too. And do you think that sort of that framing of the framing that sort of has framed queerness as being a Western import in a lot of these countries has also allowed for the rise of homo nationalism in places like Australia or the UK or the US, because it's sort of being pitted as a Western values versus non-Western values in some kind of way?
Well, I feel like it's really difficult to separate those two things. I mean, they're sort of two sides of the same, discourse, I guess, that, it is true that the way that we talk about, this is where I get into trouble by using queerness so freely, because it was really not, it doesn't really fit. It is more just kind of LGBTI identities, because it's true that LGBTI identities are a kind of construct of a very specific cultural context, as we've talked about on the podcast before. And so, like, it is just kind of literally true to say, well, that's not something that is defined in our culture in the same way for countries potentially outside of that cultural context. So I think that that's part of it. But it's also kind of understandable that this sort of rhetoric around, like, that escalating into anti-queer violence, and often very horrifically so, is kind of framed as a project of resistance to the West, when, discourses like homo nationalism are explicitly pitting those things against each other. Like, when you create that sort of a ideological battleground, those outcomes make sense.
And I think maybe this...
That's also not to in any way suggest that, people promoting... I would never want to kind of suggest a kind of causal relationship between the kind of really extreme, horrific violence against people in these places. I just want to make that clear that it's more kind of complex and diffuse than that.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, totally. I think what I was going to say is this comes to the crux of why homo nationalism is such a repugnant thing to me, more than anything else. I mean, leaving the racism aside, which is obviously extraordinarily repugnant, the thing that I think I hate the most about it is that it is a form of ideology that has no actual concern for queer people who live in a particular place, in a particular place where there is a backlash going on at that point of time. In that, what it actually does, if you actually look at it, and particularly in the context where where a lot of anti-queer backlash is framed around sort of anti-Western ideals, is it has the absolute potential to reinforce that backlash so strongly, reinforce that anti-gay prejudice, that it shows a complete disregard for the lives of people who are suffering in those places. And not even just like a, we're disregarding their cultural practices or, queer people's religion, if we're talking about gay Muslims, for example, or anything like that, but just that it shows, a homo nationalism is inherently going to create resistance in a country in which it's directed. That resistance is probably naturally going to be directed at the queer people of that country. And so, in this sort of like, look how amazing we are at, being amazing, proponents of gay rights in our country, we're actually just making things worse for other people in the way that we're doing it. And that for me is the thing that pisses me off the most, I would say.
Yeah, no, that's totally fair. I mean, it's, and I guess framed like that, it just puts it in. I mean, it's ideological colonialism, I guess, in a
So,
fairly direct way.
yeah, absolutely, absolutely, and but I guess maybe that was my like little strident little statement. Maybe to tone it down a little bit, though maybe what's it is worth asking is sort of we had some questions here about like okay, so we do have this backlash in these sorts of in these places. We do have quite a lot of that occurring. In it, we mentioned we listed a bunch of countries and regions just before. How can we engage in those broader issues without engaging in homo nationalism? How can we engage in those broader issues without sort of taking the strident nationalist perspective?
Sure. I mean, it's interesting because we there are a series of questions that we sort of had to talk about that are all like almost like critiques of the critique and kind of going, well, I feel like we've dealt with the easy stuff and now it's like, but there's lots of actually really it is really confronting to sort of look at the violence that happens to queer people around the world and what to not just want to do something about it. But I almost feel like of those different critiques that we've framed, that this is almost the easiest one to answer because, and
Yeah,
it's one,
probably.
and it's one that we've talked about before as well. This was ended up, I think, sort of being the crux of the issue we did last year, the issue, the episode that we did last year on Russia and I guess kind of queers and international issues, which is to just like ask queer communities in those places, make a conscious effort to amplify and listen to and respect the voices of queers that are actually having to deal with this stuff. And that's not always possible, but it's often possible and not done.
Yeah, okay. I think maybe I did go for the easy question then, because I think that I think that you're probably I think I mean I think that is the most obvious answer, and one that is not really done very well. Maybe to expand on that though, and going back to one of the harder questions, I mean, in doing that process, is there something that we should be saying about the West and about the progress that I would say undoubtedly has occurred in the West? Should we be presenting that as a model to other places as a way for people to move forward? Why can't we say, look how well things have gone here to countries and places that are where at the moment you could argue it's not going so well for queer people?
Totally. Yeah, this is such a tricky question. I think I would have two things to say about it. The first is, as I touched on before, the question of hypocrisy, which is that it's, we probably shouldn't be talking about this paradise that we have without also engaging with the things that we still have yet to do, and the things that are still in a lot of cases really bad in countries that would, that like Australia, that would kind of say that we have that things are really good for queer people. So I think that that's the first point. The other point I would make is that it is, you know, is a sort of broad point about colonialism, which is that it's like really, really bad and and kind of ruined the world, and you know the world, you know most of the kind of large scale like socio-political, socio-economic kind of problems that operate on a global scale are the kind of fallout from the kind of rampant and violent colonialism that has occurred over the last few centuries, and that cultural colonialism, I guess, is a kind of extension of that. And so it's really, really difficult to to exert even cultural power on a large scale around, you know, saying that your cultural ideas or your cultural context is superior to another without that just doing a lot of damage, even if we think that that's true, even if we can kind of, you know, imagine that that might help particular people. We have so much evidence to show that in the long run, it's just really, really bad. And the effects of that are really, really damaging and very long lasting. And so, yeah, I don't know. I don't really have an answer to it beyond, like, we have so much evidence to show that this can go really badly, so we should just be so fucking careful. And maybe that's to the point that you just can't do it.
Yeah, I think, I mean, this goes to something that I've noticed recently, and probably noticed quite a bit because of, you know, debates not around queer issues, but debates around terrorism, which is not a debate I really want to get into because it's not our podcast and it's not something I'm an expert on.
Terrorism podcast, let's do it. No, let's not do that.
But so I think what I have noticed, though, is so queer groups in Australia, at least, are very, very willing to criticise Christianity or criticise the Christian church very strongly. We've seen this a lot with the Margaret Court debate recently, sort of a willingness to sort of go in on conservative Christian churches and the sort of culture that and the ideology that they sort of spout. Margaret Court, again, something I don't really want to get into because I'm so sick of it. But anyway.
So just to briefly explain to people who may not be aware or are listening to this a while ago, she's the former tennis champion, came out and, I don't really know, said some homophobic stuff and everyone's angry about it. That's pretty much all you need to know.
We were thinking about doing an episode on it and then we were like, that would be the crux of the episode and I don't think we could do much else.
Yeah, I know. That's all we have to say.
Anyway, so, you know, one could argue, and I think it's an interesting argument to engage with, that if we're so willing to make that criticism of organized Christianity, why not be able to make that criticism of organized Islam? And I think that there is some debate around that, particularly in relation to terrorism at the moment. I think there's debate around that in relation to gay rights, for example. And I think that, and it's a challenging thing because I think that it is possible to look at that as at an organized level and not so much at a personal level. You know, you see these people who say we must rid the world of Islam, and I am definitely not justifying that statement at all. But I think that the potential to challenge it at organized level is there in a very, very careful kind of way. Mm. But coming back to your point of colonialism, I think it's very, very challenging because even if you want to make those critiques, the history of colonialism is so strong and so difficult and so ingrained with this sort of Western imperialism that to do it automatically brings up that history of colonialism that makes it really, really, really difficult and makes it almost impossible to do without the potential of there being this sort of counter backlash, that we've sort of spoken about a little bit earlier.
Totally. And well, so, I feel like you can pretty much guarantee that you will cause harm. You can maybe hope that there will be a positive side effect, but, you know, one of them's a certain, one of them's not.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And so it's a challenging thing because, you know, there's the part of me who honestly wants to feel more comfortable critiquing organized Islam. And again, I just really, really want to reinforce that I'm not saying critiquing Islam or Islamic people, but critiquing organized elements of a religion that I think has that does problematic things, just as I would say other organized elements of pretty much all religions do problematic things. But that sort of history of colonialism makes it very, very difficult to be able to do that in a way that won't create that harm. And I think that's really challenging. And I guess that's where we come back to the question of working with people in those countries or supporting people in those countries and helping people do that work, because it is often, you know, it's the critiques of organized conservative religion within Western countries that have helped change, you know, make Western countries have some more progressive outcomes in relation to queer people, you know, with acknowledging the problems that still exist and the major issues that we have, not just in relation to queer people, but, you know, other minority groups as well. But working within those countries to help fix those problems is going to be far better off, because you're sort of, you're minimizing that capacity for that harm to occur, while still potentially finding some positives.
You're critiquing the culture from within the culture. I mean, that's the thing. I think there's something to be said here about, like, I don't know, that, like, I was almost going to say secularism, which is what I want to say, but I'm worried that I'll just kind of fall down a rabbit hole I won't be able to get out of. When you were talking before about wanting to be able to critique organized Islam, but not Islam as a religion or Islamic people, I think that idea is, like, essentially a fantasy, you know, in that, in, well, I mean, for two reasons, partly because the whole, you know, discourse around terrorism and, you know, all the kind of anti-Islam stuff over the last, particularly over the last 15 or so years, 20 years, has been about pitting the West against Islam. And so, you know, it, like, there is an complete conflation between the religion and all these parts of the world. So that's part of the problem. The other thing is that in most parts of the world, there is a conflation between religion and culture, that those things kind of line up. That this idea, this kind of, now I'm just getting back to this kind of secularism stuff, which I don't know if I can talk about intelligently enough, but when we talk about critiquing Christianity from within a country like Australia, we're effectively critiquing Christianity from within a Christian culture, like what is, like, a tradition that we are basically a part of. Even if we call ourselves atheist, you know, we're still basically a Christian country. I think that's important to acknowledge. And I don't mean it in I don't mean it in the way that kind of conservative politicians say that, where it's like, you know, you should all go to church. It's more about kind of acknowledging that we are that white Australia is embedded in this the history of this religion. I feel like, because we don't really recognize that or have an awareness of that, because we hold on to kind of ideas like secularism and atheism in a country like Australia, we imagine that we can make those distinctions in other places and with other religions. And I'm just not sure that's as possible as we might like to pretend that it is.
Yeah, I think that makes I think that's a fair point. And it's probably one that I would agree with, despite the challenges that it brings, yeah.
Yeah, so it's kind of like, you get to the end here and it's like, you know,
Home nationalism is bad.
Home nationalism is bad.
And
I don't know how you kind of critique these things. I think very cautiously and through the kind of voices of the queers who are kind of in these places. I also just want to say, because, you know, that I may just be, like, way off with what I was saying before about kind of secularism and religions in other parts of the world. I'd be curious to hear people's feedback if they completely disagree, because I'm not, you know, I'm certainly not a theologian or anything like that.
Yeah, no, I don't think either of us can claim expertise in that area.
No, and I guess that's just a kind of a sense that I get more than anything. And at the very least, that conflation has been set up by the broader sort of political discourse around these issues.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, maybe at that point, though, we can wrap up for today.
Let's do it.
Yeah. Thank you, everybody, for listening, as always. And we'll be back in a couple of weeks with another episode.
In the meantime, you can catch us on queers.podomatic.com or subscribe to us on iTunes. And of course, if you do, leave us a review and rating, which will help other people find us. You can also send us an email at queerspodcast@gmail.com.
And you can find us on Twitter. I'm at Simon Copland, and I'm also on Facebook at Simon Copland Writer.
And I'm on Twitter at Ben C. Riley.
That's all for today, and we will see you all next time.
Bye.